issue of human rights has long been one of the thorniest issues in the U.S.-China relationship. Both countries publish annual reports lambasting the perceived human rights violations of the other country, and U.S. condemnation of Chinese policies in Xinjiang affecting the Uyghur population routinely dominate media headlines as well as the attention of policymakers in both countries. But one human rights issue to which little attention is paid by either country, relatively speaking, is the illicit massage business in the United States, an industry whose trafficking victims are nearly all of Chinese descent. Why are these victims primarily all Chinese? Who are the operators of these businesses, and who are the clients? What can be done to combat these illegal activities? And specifically, what can the United States and China do to stop human trafficking and support current victims? My name is Yuhua Tran, and welcome to the Bush China Foundation podcast. Joining me today to share more information about the U.S. illicit massage industry and its victims, and most importantly, what can be done to fight this industry, is Chris Muller-Tabanera, Chief Strategy Officer at The Network. Chris, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Hua. It's great to join you, and thank you for having me on the Bush China Foundation podcast.
The Network is an intelligence-driven counter-human trafficking organization. Chris leads the network's efforts to defeat traffickers by learning how their business works, identifying their vulnerabilities, creating risk, and then strategically disrupting it. He speaks and writes extensively about the illicit massage industry, is featured in numerous articles on the issue, and is a contributing author for the book, The Historical Roots of Human Trafficking, Informing Primary Prevention of Commercialized Violence. Chris, can you start by giving us an overview of the illicit massage industry in the U.S., such as the size and the extent of the market?
The illicit massage industry, in my opinion, is arguably one of the most prolific and misunderstood forms of human trafficking in the United States. What we're referring to are these illicit massage businesses that are establishments that put on the facade of a legitimate massage business or bodywork business, ultimately to facilitate commercial sex operations. As we look at the data and what we see online through different review sites and advertising sites, there's an estimated 12,000 illicit massage businesses active right now in all 50 states. And just for comparison, that's more storefronts than Burger King and KFC combined. And if you look at the estimates of how much illicit revenue this industry is generating as a whole across the country, that number is around $4.5 billion. So whether you're in big cities or the suburbs, this industry is thriving. It is everywhere. It is incredibly profitable, and it is exploiting the vulnerable every day.
Can you tell us more about who is involved, such as those profiting from this industry, the clientele, and the victims? Let's start with the victims.
Women in the illicit massage industry are almost exclusively East Asian women, and the overwhelming majority are Chinese immigrant women, often in their 40s. Women in this industry are often experiencing an intersection of a number of vulnerabilities, from social, economic to political vulnerabilities. Many speak limited English. Many are mothers who are primary caretakers. Many have come to the United States but are experiencing an unstable immigration status, whether they're undocumented or overstayed a visa, and therefore often lack formal work authorization. So when we think about those in the industry and their age, their language capacity, their education level, and their skills, often these limits give them limited access to the legitimate job market. And on top of that, many women are often under the pressure of incredible debt, whether that's debt to their traffickers, to their bosses, whether that's debt just coming into the United States and just being able to migrate here and all the travel costs and exorbitant fees that they had to pay to get here. So again, women in this industry are often struggling from a number of vulnerabilities, trying to make it and survive here in the United States.
And who are the clients or the buyers frequenting these illicit massage businesses?
When it comes to the demand and the sex buyers, often research shows that The buyer demographics generally reflect the demographics of the community. But what's important to note here, there was a groundbreaking report in 2018 that looked at sex buyers, and they classified individuals who would buy sex weekly or monthly as high frequency buyers. This group makes up about 25% of active buyers, but they account for nearly 75% of the commercial sex transactions that happen in the marketplace. And the important thing to note here is that this group of high frequency buyers listed their favorite venue to buy sex in this report. And what did they name? Illicit massage businesses. And additional distinction about this group compared to the other general demographics is that high frequency buyers are predominantly males who are more likely to earn over $100,000 annually. And there was a study done by Polaris that analyzed different activity on a website called RubMaps. It's the most popular sex buyer review site for illicit massage businesses. And the data show that those who were active on the site skewed significantly more Caucasian, wealthier, and older than the general internet population. And the racist and sexist comments on these sites are overwhelming. And I think it's important to name this because if you contrast that with the majority of women in the industry who are Asian immigrant women, it's very clear that whether a woman is trafficked or exploited or there by circumstance, they are experiencing a number of vulnerabilities, while the sex buyers who are driving this economy are primarily older white men with protections like a U.S. passport, disposable income. So however you want to address the conversation about privilege, whether it's race, gender, class, citizenship, employability, it's clear to me that the sex buyer has the monopoly on power on the relationship in this industry.
And finally, what about the traffickers, those profiting from this industry?
Traffickers in this industry, we see operating in a number of ways. Based on case study analysis and based on our research, the industry appears to be loosely organized by what we would kind of identify as ethnically distinct networks. So, for example, Thai organized crime or Thai traffickers who are exploiting Thai victim workers who were originating from Thailand, whether that's being trafficked from the source, so being recruited from Thailand, using broker to get to the U.S. and funneled directly into illicit massage businesses, or if it's Thai immigrants who are here and experiencing some form of job vulnerabilities who were recruited into the industry, we see it happening that way. Another form that is arguably the largest is the Chinese illicit massage networks. And again, these often are incredibly homogenous. Similarly, Korean networks connected to Korean American gangs. And you see this kind of ethnic continuity from trafficker to bosses to ultimately women who are exploited. We see clusters of businesses and networks of storefronts who are often owned by a single individual or a group or an LLC. You have few that are kind of independently owned and operate in what we would call a franchise model. But whether it's a franchisee or a network of organized businesses, often they're connected to what we would call core services, where women are being recruited, where there's a debt being added, where there's money being washed, you name it. We see this consistently across the country. And ultimately, traffickers being very profitable because they are able to provide customers or sex buyers with anonymity and a very low risk participation in the commercial sex market by having storefronts just out there in plain sight. It provides this gaze of legitimacy and ultimately a shared safe space that says, hey, this is just a massage. And it provides that deniability for bosses and traffickers. And it provides that deniability and that risk-free space for those who are buying sex.
Chris, I think that many people may be aware that most illicit massage business workers are of East Asian descent. But I think not nearly as many know that almost all of the victim workers are Chinese. Can you talk a little bit about when and how did the industry become primarily composed of Chinese victims?
And as we look at the early 2000s, from different police reports and different news articles, even talking with folks in the anti-trafficking field, you originally saw this through the lens of a majority of workers and victims were Korean. and this was connected to different Korean organized crime or Korean American gangs. It's hard to know when the shift happens, but you start seeing reports as well as through qualitatively working with partners, the shifting from seeing it primarily as a victims who are of Korean descent to be primarily Chinese, to where now we see it from our best estimates and looking at research, around 84% of women who are being exploited are Chinese immigrant women, which again is alarming to think about as we think about those being targeted and exploited in this particular form.
Thanks, Chris. It really is alarming to know and definitely heartbreaking. You mentioned that some of them are already in the country, but I'm wondering for those that are perhaps coming directly from China into the U.S. and straight into this business, what are the role that traffickers on the ground in China are playing?
Yes, traffickers, when we think about the role that they are playing in China, again, it can be a lot of different forms of facilitating this organized crime. I would say it starts with some form of fraudulent recruitment. Many women are met with false promises related to coming to the United States and the type of work that they will be doing. Often we see traffickers overseas lying about the working conditions, lying about the working hours, and lying about the type of work, particularly when it comes to what type of work will they be doing. Is there certain education requirements? Is there certain certifications or licensure that's needed? All in all, you see this almost historically of a consistent recruitment tactic of, hey, there is a promising work opportunity with financial benefit for you, and I can help you get there. So you see this recruitment happening overseas in China. Often it's a friend of a friend or someone from the same hometown. So there's a immediate feeling and sense of trust. But often that recruitment is quickly led into some form of debt bondage or some form of obligation to have to pay back. So whether it's the travel costs, whether it's the ability to get fake licensure or the ability to attain a visa. All in all, you see this recruitment process to ultimately get women to the U.S. And depending on how high contact it is, sometimes it's directly to a handler here in the United States. Sometimes that's to a courier or to a driver to get them into a business. But we see that recruitment start in China, again, really about the type of work or the type of money they'll make, only to be confronted with the reality once they get here that what they're being promised isn't actually true.
Given that this is such a huge industry, and again, with players across the world in China and the United States, I'm wondering, what are the biggest challenges to combating the illicit massage industry in the U.S.?
There are many challenges that we're dealing with here in the U.S. I would say the first starts with misunderstanding. There's a lot of misinformation and just thinking about the industry as something that's harmless, that there are no victims, and then it's no big deal. Or people know that there might be something going on, or everybody sort of talks about it under their breath, but they sort of feel that it's, well, again, no big deal, or it's just willing prostitution. And so there's a grave misunderstanding of the reality of exploitation and violence that actually happens to women who are working in these establishments. And when we don't have that proper understanding, it obviously often leads to zero response. I think another big challenge is the reality of racism as we think about this industry. So many of the women, whether Chinese or from other East Asian or Southeast Asian countries, are being dealt with harmful and degrading stereotypes. And so there is often this deprioritization in the anti-trafficking field when it comes to needing to provide better access and care or prevention and protection of those being victimized in this industry. We can compare that to Other common victims of trafficking in the United States, for example, think about homeless youth or runaway youth, someone who may be a U.S. citizen, someone who may be under the age of 18. And when it comes to resources and prioritization for those trying to enforce or combat the problem, often when we think about adult immigrant Asian women, those in institutions are deprioritizing that from being a priority for them to combat and to focus on. A third is just the sheer size of the problem. When you think about the number of businesses across the country, often those looking to combat or enforce against this are intimidated to even start, or they're just struck by a belief that, hey, this is so big, it'll never go away. So why even try? So when I think about the reality of the size of the problem, when I think about the reality of racism that plays into decision-making from those who have authoritative enforcement power, or just the reality of how gravely misunderstood the problem is, these are the things that make combating the victimization that's happening in the illicit massage industry such an uphill battle.
With all the significant challenges, it does sound like it will take a lot of different players and entities to fight against this. So to start with, I'm wondering if you can share a little bit about what has the United States as a government done to crack down on these illegal activities that are happening on U.S. soil? And also, does the Chinese government have any policies in place to address the trafficking of its citizens that starts in China?
Well, U.S. has laws through the Trafficking Victims Protection Act to have an ability to prosecute and protect those who are being victimized and defined as trafficking victims. The challenge has become really on a federal level is what to do, particularly with this form of trafficking. So beyond the legislation that's in place at a federal level, I think the ability of that to actually implement down towards specific forms of trafficking, particularly that are more complex, like the illicit massage industry, we've seen little action and little impact. And as far as the coordination between the U.S. and China, again, the more we ask, the little I feel that we know if anything is being done. I think you hear a little bit from our side of the United States government pointing the finger, as well as sort of a dismissing of the reality of how vast this is. Part of this becomes, hey, if this was such a big problem and there are all these victims who are coming from China or migrating to the U.S. through these different methods, we should be hearing all these victims crying out and speaking out. Well, the reality is that radically minimizes the complexity of how victimization occurs. It radically minimizes the trauma and the shame that often women experience from having this happen to them and their ability to speak out about it. And so the way the narrative goes is, hey, because we're not hearing about all these victims, therefore there can't actually be trafficking. Therefore, if there's no trafficking, there's no problem and there is no real need to act. So that is often how the narrative goes as we think about it rising up to federal action. And particularly, again, that's in the context of some of the history between these governments communicating with each other in order to find a solution for both sides.
Definitely. I think the finger pointing is a big issue in U.S.-China relationship, obviously not only on this issue, but unfortunately on a whole host of issues. And I understand that that's a larger issue, as you said, in the bilateral relationship as a whole. So we understand that to be the reality right now, but I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about, in an ideal world with both countries getting along and able to work together, what more could the two governments be doing, whether that is on their own or bilaterally?
Yeah, I think the two things that I can think of are, one, it has to start with conversation and not denying reality. And I think number two is seeing on either the sending or receiving side of migration, what protections can we put in place to protect our most vulnerable from being harmed and exploited? I think number one, if we can't talk about the reality of the problem, it's hard to even think about coming up with smart solutions that are actually going to be effective. Part of this, I think, is sharing intelligence. When there are those who are victimized and have given testimony or shared about the methods in which they migrated to the U.S., the way that they were trained ultimately to pass immigration, you name it. What are some trends or what are some patterns that can potentially be gleaned from to say, hey, this actually looks like there's something fraudulent happening here. It looks like someone is being kind of pushed or forced into a situation that they don't fully understand what is actually happening to them. So from getting to the reality of trafficking that's happening from source country to how those methods occur and being able to talk through, are there ways that there can be an intervention before this happens? And then second, when it comes to protections, are there ways from that, from not just coming and having a conversation about the problem, that we can have those shared protections implemented? Whether that's more public service announcements and education, whether that's being a little clearer on the U.S. side, or what are, for example, different labor laws and how we do things here and what should be expected for the worker or what should be expected when they enter into a business. Because often women are being told a certain thing that is not reality. And so when they come into the U.S. and are looking for work, they are set up at a disadvantage from understanding what rights are they entitled to, or what is normal and what is cultural here in the U.S. and what protections do they have. So I think the misinformation and misunderstanding is over the top, particularly when it comes to protecting those who are most vulnerable when they come to the U.S. So as we start diving deeper into those conversations, I think there will be greater intelligence in being able to identify how do we have interventions here to protect women either from coming into the U.S. safely, or once they're here, making sure that they understand the rights and protections they have being in the United States.
Is there anything that's being done at the subnational level, you know, within the states in the U.S., the provinces in China, or within municipalities in either country, or by non-government entities? Are there things that should be done and can be done at that local level versus by the federal government?
There are a number of things being done on the more local level to combat these crimes. The first would be approaching the problem in the illicit massage industry from a law enforcement perspective through an all crimes approach versus, say, a trafficking only approach. And what we mean by this is actually bringing and implementing a more traditional organized crime network-based target when it comes to identifying traffickers in the illicit massage industry, being able to look at financial crimes, being able to look at RICO, racketeering, different money laundering schemes. Basically, it's like the kitchen sink approach to holding network criminals accountable versus waiting for a trafficking victim to come forward. Traditionally, in the anti-trafficking space, it's not until a trafficking victim speaks out about their experiences, what's happening to them, for law enforcement to open up an investigation into that specific crime happening to that victim. That puts so much burden on the victim. And not only that, it's a very reactive approach. So to have a more organized crime, networked activity framing of the problem, you can start building cases by looking into these different elements without having to wait for a trafficking victim to come forward to open up a case. In addition to that criminal approach, we see the more civil approach being a regulatory methodology. And that really is how our local areas creating inoperable environments so that these businesses can operate without accountability. And this looks like strengthening regulations, strengthening oversight, particularly to massage establishments with preventative measures and protective measures for the workers and the businesses, so that these businesses can't just open up and close as they see fit, but they're in a way being cleared out because the oversight and the regulatory environment is no longer allowing them to operate, and taking that in a much more civil kind of action type of way. And the last thing that we see being done is actually building stronger bonds between the Asian American and Pacific Islander community and those who are working in the anti-trafficking field. And I think so many of us who are working in the social justice space are isolated or working on islands and not understanding how do we need to actually learn from each other, ultimately to serve the same population that we're trying to work with, particularly as we think about how specific those who are being victimized in the illicit massage industry are primarily Asian immigrants. There are AAPI community-based organizations that have been working with this population for years and decades, but are often disconnected or uninformed about the reality of the illicit massage industry and who it's targeting and who it's exploiting. And vice versa, you have anti-trafficking organizations who may have specialized services for those who are being victimized by this crime. They don't have the language or the cultural access to be able to better serve and understand those they are trying to work with. So whether it's that building stronger bonds to improve access and quality of service provision, whether it's taking a more civil approach to create inoperable environments, or a more all crimes, organized crime networked approach to the problem, these are three different ways that we're seeing on a more local level that entities are using and employing to try and combat these crimes.
Just now you mentioned about the role that AAPI organizations could play and the need to break down silos in the AAPI community. And earlier you had mentioned that one of the challenges to combating the illicit massage industry in the US is the reality of racism. And so in that vein, I wanted to shift the conversation to look more at this question of the AAPI angle. The increase in anti-Asian rhetoric and hate crimes in this country over the past few years have dramatically increased attention towards AAPI issues. And given that the vast majority of illegal massage business victims are Asian, it does seem like the heightened advocacy for the Asian American community and the increased activism of many of these AAPI groups should aid efforts to combat these illicit businesses. Has that been the case?
Yeah, I think there's a big opportunity here. I think number one, for those of us in the AAPI community, and particularly those who are serving this community, it's been an overwhelming couple years, to put it simply. That being said, I think what often captures attention are the headlines or the massive kind of headline events. And so what ends up happening is we miss the daily acts of violence that are often experienced within those in the margins of the AAPI community, because they're not, quote unquote, qualified as breaking news. It's something that's happening every day. And so how can we kind of raise the bar of how are we serving those in our community on that daily basis beyond just the heightened advocacy that's increased because of the increase in anti-Asian rhetoric over the last couple of years? And so I think as a community, we are still recovering from the traumatic events that we've been seeing and that we've continued to experience. I think one of the challenges actually is having the hard conversation or getting the full story. I know even for myself, there are things within the community that I am even unaware of. And so how do we become more aware of all the things that are affecting those in our community, particularly those on the margins? And I think when you look at the tragedies in Atlanta and more recently the tragedies in New Mexico, beyond the headline of assault, robbery, and murders, having the conversation of what's happening at the deeper level, what is happening to create these industries where women who are experiencing vulnerabilities are having to experience different forms of violence and racism on a daily basis, and how do we attack it at a more systematic and systemic level beyond what becomes the headline, and understand that, hey, this is happening at different levels every day. And so how can we see that opportunity and build that bridge? I think it's important. I think that opportunity is being seized right now, and there's a lot more work to be done.
So to unpack that a little bit, can you talk a little bit more specifically about how racism specifically against Asians or racist stereotypes of Asian women, how does all of that play a part in this industry?
When we think about the illicit massage industry, for me, it is driven by racist stereotypes against Asian women. And this is not accidental, and this didn't happen overnight. There are so many historical roots that are contributing to the current industry that we see today. So whether we go back a century and look at the different wars and different conflict zones that were created through imperial wars in the Asia Pacific, and the comfort stations that were created, and this justification that through soldiers in war dealing with their trauma, they can take out that trauma through sexually exploiting Asian women. Whether we think about the racist immigration policies in the United States from the Chinese Exclusion Act or the PAGE Act, there is such specific language written into legislation about Asian women being a moral threat to what I would say white America. When you think about media portrayal, again, going back centuries from Madame Butterfly to Miss Saigon, we think about films like Full Metal Jacket, even Rush Hour 2, more recently Austin Powers, even in the 2000s in the series The Office, you have this consistent portrayal of Asian women being exotic, submissive, fetishized, and hypersexualized in pop culture. And this shouldn't be just in some shallow sense flattering. This should be recognized and understood and identified as harm. It is erasing individuals. It is erasing culture. It is erasing individuals' story to become an object for consumption. And so when we think about the market today or the industry today, this is built off of this of these stereotypes that have been creative for over a century about Asian women, and that ultimately they are here to serve a more dominant privileged culture, and this is kind of their place. And I think if we can't name and call that out, our solutions are ultimately going to be ineffective, because we got to get to the root of the racism that's driving ultimately the sex buying and ultimately the justification of harm that's happening every day, and normalizing it to where there's no reaction or no response taken.
So what are some very specific actions that AAPI groups in the United States could be doing right now to help address these issues of racism that you've talked about, and then, of course, the larger issue of combating the illegal massage business?
Well, I think a couple of things. Number one, I think the AAPI community right now is doing an incredible job of calling out racism, is standing up to the white supremacy that's been built into systems for centuries here in the United States. So I think, number one, like, it's been, as an individual, very proud to be a part of the AAPI community in these last couple of years, despite experiencing incredible amounts of consistent trauma. The ability to rise up and to stand up and to speak out has been incredible. I think in addition to that, when it comes into the integration with the illicit massage industry, it goes both ways. It's not just AAPI community, it's also the anti-trafficking community, where we can often feel overwhelmed because of funding and programs. We end up in silos and not understanding that we actually need each other when it comes to solutions. So I think, how can we build access to both learn from each other about how has a different programs within the AAPI community better served a specific population and learn from any harm that's been done in the past? I think anti-trafficking as well has so much to offer when it comes to the reality of trauma and exploitation, and how to best serve those coming out of something as a form of labor or sex trafficking, in addition to the cultural elements that are at play here. So I think, number one, having the harder conversations. I think, number two, building access across the AAPI anti-trafficking and broader gender violence, gender-based violence field to learn from each other. Because in the end, when we don't, those on the margins are continually going to be missed. And I think when we think about the illicit massage industry, that's what we're talking about. We are talking about women who are on extreme margins, particularly in this country, and being exploited in these businesses. And so that, to me, is kind of the beginning of how we sort of learn from each other and strengthen the response to this industry.
In addition to all that you've already talked about in terms of what governments can and should do and what specific organizations can and should do, I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the individual, whether that individual is AAPI or just any individual. What can people be doing on their own to help combat these illegal businesses and to help these victims?
That's a great question. And I think on multiple levels for an individual, one is just, again, naming and calling out any form of stereotypes that are minimizing the beauty, the reality, the strength of the Asian American community. When this is witnessed, when we are silent or when we are passive, these stereotypes continue to have a life and they continue to ultimately escalate towards harm. So on a very individual level, when those are seen and noticed, calling that out and having the hard conversation. I think number two is if you have the financial means to actually give to service providers and agencies who are serving the AAPI community or the anti-trafficking community. It's so sad to say, but as much as there is awareness of the reality of trafficking or those who are experiencing anti-Asian hate, funding is still limited. So if we want to talk about solutions, we actually need to fund it. I think another one way that individuals can help is there is a lot of policy that is very active right now, locally and statewide, when it comes to regulating the illicit massage industry and the best way forward. The reality is There are so many loopholes and poor, outdated legislation. So those who are trying to civilly enforce or regulate and protect the industry, both the practitioners and the businesses and the customers for legitimate massage, because of those loopholes and the weakness in regulations, illicit massage businesses and the bosses and traffickers are taking advantage of that. So there is legislation consistently coming up. And when that comes, if you're a voter, to please voice your opinion or voice to your elected officials how you want to protect communities and that there needs to be stronger regulation and oversight of massage businesses in order to do that. And lastly, if you're a concerned citizen and you want to bring this up with either city officials or law enforcement, you can reach out even directly to the network. We love working with communities to talk through solutions. This isn't as simple as just calling law enforcement and reporting, because there might be an overreaction and an arrest of a worker, which again is not the solution. There has to be sort of an established, how big is this problem locally? What are the best ways to combat it? And who needs to be at the table? So you can reach out to the network. And we're glad to work with individuals about how to find solutions and work with officials to move forward.
All of this has been so helpful, Chris. And you know, for me, I wasn't aware of almost any of the information that you've given us today. And so I think the first step to any individual organization or governments doing anything is awareness. So you know, thank you again so much just for sharing all of this. And I hope that through this podcast, we can just help to make people a little bit more aware of what is going on out there and what all of us can be doing to help. And so finally, I want to just give you an opportunity to share any last thoughts that you might have on this issue or other important issues that you're working on.
A few things I just want to name. Number one, as we think about creating solutions and doing what's right, I think what's first most important is actually hearing about stories and realities of what's actually happening behind closed doors in these businesses. When we miss this story and these personal narratives, we ultimately don't get to the truth. So one thing that I'm proud at the network that we're working on is a series of survivor videos and stories to elevate and empower the voices of those who have experienced exploitation and trafficking in these businesses so that they can show, hey, this needs to stop. This needs to end. I think there is a conversation right now around the politics of prostitution, around choice, around safety and what should be legal or not. I think what often gets missed are the survivors of prostitution and the survivors of sex trafficking in these conversations. And so number one, I think that's needs to guide our conversation, and there'll be more to come on that from the network. I think a second thing that we're working on that I think is important is sharing data and doing that generously. Again, what we've learned is that data shifts the conversation. When we understand the magnitude of the problem, that this is not over there, but it's right here in our communities, it actually can better inform our response versus just acting on feeling. How can we actually understand it from a number standpoint, from a financial standpoint, from a network standpoint? Again, that should be the basis for any response that we're proud to be working on and to continue to work on in the field. The third thing that I would just name is we are organizing a national convening in January 2023 during Human Trafficking Awareness Month. This is to gather and to build a more comprehensive and ultimately a holistic response to trafficking in the illicit massage industry. Because we can't do it alone, it's going to take a number of actors. We're hosting this event with the National Association of Attorneys General, with amazing service providers like Garden of Hope and Thai CDC, as well as the California Massage Therapy Council and the amazing organization called Equitas, who is training and leading law enforcement and prosecutors across the country. This content will be for government officials, for law enforcement, for service providers, for those in the API community to learn not just about the problem, but what are the steps we can take to build a more comprehensive response so that women are no longer exploited in this industry. So those are just a few things that we're excited about at the network that are coming out. The last thing I'll say is that when it comes to this industry, we've been tracking the data, and this industry has been growing consistently since we started measuring it in 2016. And what I know as a fact is that when we do nothing, the industry just continues to grow, meaning the exploitation of women in our communities will continue to increase, and that sex buyers will continue to be able to pay for pleasure without consequence, and that traffickers will continue to profit without any accountability. And so when I think about this, it demands a response. It may start with just awareness and conversation, but it ultimately leads to what are the actions we can take. The industry today, as we've talked about throughout this podcast, is not random. It is not harmless. It is not accidental. It is a legacy of trauma. It is a legacy of racism, of sexism, of poverty. And so the question I ask myself every day at the organization, as well as in the community, is what will be our legacy? I hope that it won't continue to be this industry all over the country, because the reality is it's not just a massage. And so I encourage everyone who's listening to see what they can do to learn more and ultimately ask the question, what can I do to shift this legacy, not just for myself, but for those women who are experiencing the realities of violence every day.
Chris, thank you again so much for taking the time to share such eye-opening, but definitely heartbreaking information. I really admire the work that you and your colleagues and all those fighting human trafficking are doing each and every day.
Thank you, Yua. It's been a pleasure.
Remember to look for the Bush China Foundation podcast on our website, SoundCloud, and Spotify, where you can follow our conversations. As always, thank you for listening.